Welcome to Parenting Teens with Dr. Cam, the podcast dedicated to helping you tackle the challenges of parenting teenagers without the drama. I'm your host, Dr. Cam. Let's get on with the show. In today's world, teenagers are expected to excel in every aspect of their lives, academics, extracurriculars, work, and more. Parents want more than anything for their children to succeed, so they often take a lot of the responsibility and stress on themselves. But perhaps we need to take a pause for a moment and question what we mean by success. Could this hyper-focus on achievement actually be hindering rather than helping our children thrive? Today, I'm thrilled to have Julie Lythcott-Hames with us. She sparked a national dialogue challenging conventional parenting wisdom in her acclaimed book, How to Raise an Adult, and her TED Talk, How to Raise Successful Kids Without Overparenting, boasting over 7 million views, many of which are mine. Welcome, Julie. First, share a bit of your backstory with us. What inspired you to focus on overparenting?
Well, thank you for having me, Dr. Cam, and everyone listening to us. I hope you get something useful out of this. Pay attention to what comes up in your body, because that's a clue that maybe there's something that you want to pay attention to. I am the author of How to Raise an Adult, which Dr. Cam mentioned, and I wrote this having been the dean of freshman students at Stanford University for 10 years. And as a college administrator in the early 2000s, I was noticing on my campus what any college administrator at every type of campus was noticing, which was parents kind of coming to college with their kids, so to speak. Yeah. A real contrast from the 80s and the 90s, and certainly the decades before, parents needing to talk to the professor about a grade they were unhappy with. Parents thinking they should get involved in a roommate dispute. Parents really as the first line of defense and offense, parents really in the driver's seat. And I thought, oh no, wait a minute. You know, when are these kids, air quotes, one of these students of mine going to really seize that driver's seat position in their own life? Don't they need to? I'm not a psychologist. I'm a lawyer who became a college. Like, but something in me was like, something's off. And we were, of course, just starting to see kind of the rise in mental health diagnoses and challenges in the young adult population. We started to sort of connect some dots. This was all before the smartphone, by the way. You know, like, why? Yeah. Why? So I wrote this book out of compassion for young adults who I could see, however excellent they were academically on paper, they seemed to be not confident in their own abilities to kind of try something, ask a question, solve a problem. Mom or dad was sort of the handler, if you will. And so I became the author of this book, really fighting for the imperative that young adults have the chance to kind of walk their own path and have the stumbles and falls that grow a person to be stronger and more capable. And then, of course, the irony is I'm telling other parents what to do. Like, don't overparent. Turns out I was overparenting my own two kids right here at home.
Isn't that how it always happens, right? You're like, wait a second. This looks familiar. That's probably why you noticed it so much, because you're like, wait a second. It is so hard today. And one of the things that I keep noticing too is that we talk about social media being pressure on our kids in the comparison, but not enough about how it puts pressure on us parents. Because we see all these other kids excelling and we go, oh my gosh, how do I make sure my kid's excelling? My kid's not falling behind. Here's all the expectations on my kids, which is expectations on me. And if I let my child just do what they wanted, they would just play video games all day long. So I need to step in or they're not going to succeed. I hear this a lot. Like, I just need to get them into the right college and then they'll be fine. What do you say to parents with that mindset? Because there's a lot of us.
I try to use this image of like, here you are in your helicopter and you've picked up your child from, you know, age 5 and delivered them to age 6 and you've picked them up and delivered them to age 10. In other words, with your effort, you know, you have moved them along the path of life. And then at some point you, in your helicopter, you arrive them, you bring them to the summit, which you've decided is the right college, and you let them out and they stand there bewildered. They don't know what to do. because you have deprived them of the smaller steps of the easier climb when they were young, right? They didn't practice it from 5 to 8 years old. So, you know, then they didn't practice it when it was harder from 10 to 13, and they didn't practice it from 10 to 14. And now you think you've gotten them to the right college, and you think they're capable of persisting through challenges, asking for help, figuring stuff out, rebounding, like making a choice among competing options. No, because you did it for them. So it's a fallacy that all you need to do is just get them to the right college. You know, college isn't like a tourist situation. Like, you're supposed to have built the study skills and the cooperative, like work with other humans, you know, advocate for yourself, but be respectful to the others. Like, we've deprived them of the very things that will allow them to thrive once they get there. So I wasn't surprised by the rebounding. So many kids being taken to, you know, arrived at the right college by mom or dad or both, discover within a semester, if not a month, if not a week, oh, I can't do anything by myself.
Yeah. I think what's interesting is it is that self-esteem that they somehow don't have because they weren't the ones that got them there. And they know that, right? So there's this worry and fear that, A, I don't know if I know how to do it, but also this fear of it's not okay to fail. Otherwise, mom and dad would have let me do it before. And they kept jumping in whenever there was any fear of failing at all, which means, oh my gosh, that's a terrible thing. Why are we so afraid of failure?
All right. There's so much here. All of your questions are great, by the way. And what they all have at rock bottom is, you know, why are we parents so fearful? Why are we parents, you know, adhering to this narrow definition of success? Why do we need to micromanage their lives? And I'm really clear that it's a matter of our own ego, our own insecurities, our own need to prove to our friends and family on Instagram, you know, that we are a good parent because we have gotten our child this far in life. It's like, look at my child, look what I've created. Like, my child is a bonsai tree, as I discuss in my TED Talk. You know, like, I am the gardener. I have created this thing. Right. Look at this magnificent thing. Doesn't it reflect well on me? So this is, of course, really unhealthy psychologically to be so enmeshed in your child's identity that basically your child is the manifestation of your worth. Therefore, you have to act upon them constantly to shine them up and make sure that you are still worthy. I mean, it's just therapy is my number one recommendation.
It really is. But, and then doing that's going to send our kids to therapy too. So,
well, I would just say, you know, I've been there. I got a 24-year-old and a 22-year-old, and I'm the expert, so to speak. And yet, turns out I was overparenting. And my son, who's 24, came home for what I now call bonus years, mental health crisis in college right before the pandemic, left college, things got worse, came home to shelter in place. Really depressed, finally got great therapy. We went into family therapy, and I was the one to ask for it. I was like, you know, I think we have a dynamic here between your dad, you and me, that it's all about like protecting you. And like, he's lovely, he's kind, and he's smart, and he's, you know, he was always a good child. And so we never really had to, you know, like, he was just really sensitive. And so we would accommodate that sensitivity and kind of tiptoe on eggshells. And we came to realize through the work of Ellie Leibovitz at Yale, this whole, it's not okay to fail, or I'll curate your environment so you never have to encounter these things you're afraid of. We do that lovingly. Like, oh, I wouldn't want them to fail. Oh, I wouldn't want them to be afraid in the dark. Oh, I wouldn't want them to not have access to the food they love. It turns out that our accommodation, what Ellie Leibovitz calls over accommodation, basically takes a natural situation, a natural fear, you know, oh, you failed. Oh, this didn't go well. Oh, no worries. Like, the sun will come up. When we curate their lives so they don't have to experience it, it tells them psychologically that thing must be so terrifying and terrible because my parents are moving heaven and earth to make sure it doesn't happen. And to your point, you know, they get to college and then if they have a stumble, they're lost because they feel like, wait a minute, if, you know, it's definitely not okay to fail because my parents never let me fail. It must be terrifying. So now it's happening. So I must be terrified. And you can kind of unravel this. You can just see how, you know, it just becomes this big snowball. So as parents, working on our own insecurities, our own anxieties, you know, what am I so worried about? Such that, sorry, I've had like Microsoft Teams decide to start on the computer. I have no idea why. I don't even use Microsoft Teams. Anyway, getting our own wellness in order, getting our own therapy is probably one of the best things we can do to help our kids.
Completely agree. Why are people so hesitant to do that?
Well, many of us, myself included, grew up in families that didn't believe in therapy, air quotes. You know, mine came from a stiff upper lip British mom who was like, we don't have feelings. We don't talk about feelings. We just, you know, we just keep going. And for many of us, culturally, therapy is sort of a four-letter word. Like, you do not want to do it. You don't want to talk about it. So overcoming the stigma in some places associated with therapy is kind of step one. But I think also we're just doing everything, you know, we can for our kids. Why is that bad, right? So if someone's suggesting, oh, you might need therapy to stop being so entangled with your kid's life, the natural response is, I just love my kid. Why would you tell me not to love my kid? Don't I want to do everything for them to ensure their success? And here's where it gets more nuanced. Biologically, yes, we want to ensure our children live long enough to have children. That's sort of the biological DNA passing on our genes imperative, right? So yes, you're supposed to ensure they're safe, secure, fed, sheltered, and then get the hell out of their way so they can learn the skills so that they can be the parent one day. Like that, right? So it's just sort of love has become do it all for them instead of, I love you so much, I'm going to sit here and watch as you have a few struggles. I love you. I'll make sure you're not going to die, right? But I got to let life happen to you somewhat so that you can become a human. We become human beings by doing stuff with our hands, with our bodies, with our brains, by having the experience that made us go, oh, you know, so next time we do it a little bit better or a lot better. Like, that is the literal living of life. So it is not love to say, I'm going to treat my child like a football that I'm just going to carry over the yard, you know, across the goal line, right? That's your child as an inanimate object just being carried through life. Then you put that football down and expect that it can get over back across the field. No, don't treat your child like an inanimate object. Your child is a human being trying to become as capable as you are, if not more so.
That's our job.
That's our job.
To let them go, right? Our job is to be able to let them go. And so when we're doing everything for them, we're taking that away from them.
Right.
And so when we're overprotecting them, and it's hard because this world is scary. And we have all these fears about social media, fears about creepy people out in the world. We have fears about a lot of things and we want to protect them. The irony is the more we protect them, the less they learn to protect themselves. And then we throw them out into the world without any ability to persevere on their own.
That's right. That's exactly right. So we have to tolerate these, the sort of wince, we have to, the small mishaps. There's these guys in Minneapolis, I can't remember their names. I quoted them in my book years ago, a child psychologist and a pediatrician who were like, the mistakes and curveballs of life are our kids' greatest teachers. The things that make us wince a little, like, oh, you know? Yeah, back to why we need therapy. We have a hard time experiencing our children's discomfort. So we decide I can't bear to see them go through that. Therefore, I'm going to make sure it doesn't happen. Here's a beautiful, weird example. And I don't know if you can tell, but I'm ducking the sun. The sun is like coming in through the window.
Yeah, you've got this beautiful
in case people are wondering, it's like, oh, the sun. I'm in California in the morning here and the sun's coming in. So let me tell you a horrendously beautiful example.
Okay.
Rockabye baby. In the treetop, when the wind blows, the cradle will rock. When the bough breaks, the cradle will fall, and down will come baby.
Terrifying.
Okay. All of the nursery rhymes, all so of the Hans Christian Andersen books, fairy tales, fables, they are scary as
scary.
Right?
Yeah.
And in modern parenting, often we change the story. so that our child does not hear that terrible thing. And my son, 24 years old, just reminded me last night that I had done that. Cockles and muscles alive, alive. Oh, what is that song? Do you know how it starts?
I know what you're talking about, but I can't remember how it starts.
Right, it's like this lady, and she's going to buy cockles and mussels, and then she gets sick and dies. Yeah. Okay, and it's a right. So apparently, I changed the words to like
another one.
You know, I changed the words to like she was perfectly fine and had a good time, and then she went on to buy more things. Blah, blah, blah. I changed. I couldn't bear my children hearing like this lady suffered and died. Like, why do we sing us our children? Well, I think people who study children's literature, people who study developmental psychology will probably tell us that when we give them some stories that tell them about the bad things, you know, they can appreciate there's bad and there's good in my life. Like there's some scary stuff out there, but here I am and I'm safe. Like there's some kind of duality that's needed there instead of like, everything's fine all the time. No worries. Right. Like that turns out not to be a good, you know, sort of preparation for handling the stuff that's out there. Like they need to hear the studies of Hansel and Gretel escaping the witch. We don't want them to know that there's a witch or a scary, right?
Right.
Hansel and Gretel escaping. Like, look at little red frickin' Riding Hood. Like, ultimately she kills a wolf that ate her grand. That's terrifying. But, you know, she survived.
Yeah. She's tough.
She's tough. She figured it out.
She figured it out. It's right. We can overcome. I think the other thing I find interesting too is there's almost the flip that I see as well, where there's this counter to, okay, parents are overparenting, they're babying their kids, they're coddling them, they're making them so that they can't do anything on their own. And this is the problem with youth today. And then I see the reverse of we've got to toughen our kids up by being the tough person in their life. We've got to make their lives tougher so that they are strong. Have you heard that side? I hear a lot of that side of it.
I'm not hearing a lot of that. So tell me, what's the context? Is it upper middle class, working class?
That's a great question. And I don't want to define that because I don't want to like spotlight on it. But I see this a lot across cultures too, where there's this belief that I'm the one that has to be the tough person in their life. And I'm going to tell them all the bad stuff about themselves and call them names and, you know, and create that toughen them up that way.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that philosophy.
Yeah. So I heard your question wrong, which is why I asked about class.
Oh.
And I asked about class just so listeners know, because, for example, in many immigrant communities, there is a tougher love. It's like we sacrificed everything to get to this country. We worked our tails off. You know, we're going to stay on you to make sure that you are making the most of this opportunity. Which is a very different approach than a set of upper middle class, well-to-do people saying, we think your life is too cushy and, you know, we're now going to come, you know, crack down and make you do more chores or give you more responsibilities. You know, they come from different places. But to your point about like parents calling you names or like, you know, being that hard ass, look, I don't condone that at all. I don't know where that comes from as a philosophy. It sounds almost sort of like, you know, in some religions, there's this sense of, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child, like they need to be brought under control and dominated. And that feels very 18th, 19th, 20th century, but really not aligned with what we know from psychology about how humans change their behaviors, right? What punishment does versus recognition and praise and reward. You know, how do you get the right behavior? You recognize it when they do it and they want to do it more because they want, you know, that attention, right?
Hey parents, feeling overwhelmed? You don't have to do this alone. Join the Thriving Parent Academy, where community support is everything. Member Tracy said, we all developed at an exponential rate together. And Carrie admitted, I didn't think I needed this, but it's a life game changer. Don't wait. Join us at thrivingparent.org and use promo code THRIVE20 for 20% off your membership. Let's thrive together. Yeah. I think, again, this is about the intrinsic motivation versus the external motivation. Yeah. And I think that's a lot about what you're talking about as well, is when we're doing it all for them, they don't develop intrinsic motivation. And that's what's required to be resilient and persevere and do difficult things, right? I talk to a lot of teenagers, and I mean, right now, school avoidance is a growing problem. Yeah. And the kids that I talk to, the only reason they see going, the only purpose of going to school is to get their parents off their back. That's it, right? They're like, I don't see the point of it. I don't get it. So a lot of what they're doing in their lives right now that are difficult, they don't have internal motivation to do it. They're doing it only because their parents are telling them they have to.
Yeah.
How does this impact them down the road?
I look to Jessica Leahy on this. Jess is a friend and a fellow parenting author. Her books are back here in my parenting segment. And, you know, former middle school teacher who's now a journalist and an author. And, you know, she taught me about intrinsic motivation and how, you know, the sticks and carrots of external motivation, according to research, don't last very long. And whereas intrinsic motivation is that sort of self-fueled, you know, I want to, you know, I'm motivated. I will do this. And it comes from apparently these paradoxical things. Like, in order for a kid to have intrinsic motivation, they need both autonomy and connection. They need connection with us, a loving interpersonal connection where they feel loved and cared about. And then a lot of autonomy, meaning time by themselves, where we're not like, have you done your homework? Have you done your homework? Why haven't you started your homework? When are you starting your homework? 15 minutes later, have you started your homework? Like, you're right. Talking to me that, like, have you seen me do my homework? No, you're like, stop hounding me, right? That's not autonomy. Yeah. And that's not a very loving connection either, right? The loving connection is, how's your day going? Do you want a snack? You know, hope you get some downtime. I'm in the other room if you need me. Like, I love you. You know, like the warmth and the juice, and then walk away so the kid can be like, okay, right?
Yeah.
I am responsible. So the more we hound them and we're on them and we act like I have to hound you because you won't do it unless I make you, the more they're like, screw you. You can't make me, right? Or
exactly.
Fine, you are making me. In fact, Dr. Kim, I had a call from a mom who said, Julie, I finally get this point you've been making about the harmful effects of nagging and reminding. She said, I got two sons. I got a biological son who's 17 and an adopted son who's 15. My bio son has had a lot of struggles. He's in a residential boarding school in a different state. We have family therapy on the phone once a week. And in family therapy this week, he said, Mom, every time you ask, have you done this? When are you going to do this? Why haven't you done this? Don't forget to do this. Oh, I think you should do this. It makes me feel that you think I don't care or that I can't or that I won't,
right.
But I do. So just back off. So mom calls me. She's like, Julie, I get it. I'm totally that way with my biological son because I feel like half his genes are mine. So everything he does in the world is a reflection on me. Whereas with my adopted son, I know his genes aren't mine. I don't know what he's going to become. I just love the heck out of that kid and root for him to be himself. Guess which kid is psychologically healthy, right?
Yeah.
She's like, my adopted son. I am more loving toward my adopted son because she worked it out. So I tell parents, like, maybe you don't have the A/B test of your adopted kid and your biological kid. But think about how you are with your nieces and nephews and best friends' kids. You are that loving adult who doesn't judge, who doesn't act like it's yours to fix.
Right.
Like when their kid comes home, when you're at their house, you know, you're the aunt or the uncle and or the best friend of the family. It's Friday afternoon. Their kid comes home, you know, slams the kitchen door, throws the backpack down. Well, I guess I'm failing science. You as the auntie and uncle or the best friend, you're like, oh, buddy, come here. That doesn't sound very good. Hug, kiss, whatever. Like, how are you? What is good? And you're like, because it sounds like it's not the sign. Do you want a beverage? Sit down, buddy. Whereas the parent is like, what do you mean? We're failing science. I need to call the teacher. I need to check the board.
We're.
Right? We. The parent owns it as their own to deal with.
Yep.
Who does the kid feel drawn to energetically? the kid is going to sit down with that auntie, uncle, best friend of the family because they feel, okay, this is not a crisis. They're not acting like this is the be all and end all of my life. I feel connected to this person, right? They're engaging with me still. Whereas my parent is acting like I have just fallen off a cliff and that now they have to rescue me. So that's the key. It's like, you know, love shouldn't feel like an oppressive cloak of judgment and worry. Love should feel like, hey, you know, you got this. You got this.
Yeah.
Let me know if you need me, right? It's not an abandonment. Like, hey, I know a thing or two about science. If you need me, I'm always here. Okay. But how about a beverage? Yeah. Right. And moving our bodies away.
Oh, it's so hard. I think one of the hardest things I see people's parents accept is the fact that they need to do less. Because parents, when they come to me and they're having some sort of challenge with their teen, we want to do more. What more do I need to do? What more? What more? And the problem is we need to do less. And they're like, I can't do less.
Yes, you
less
can.
Less feels like I'm not trying.
Right.
Less feels like I don't care.
Right.
How do we balance this doing less but still showing how much we care?
Well, a part of it is listening to a great podcast like this where we try to say this, right? But I think this is where I said the definition of love has become like I do everything for you instead of creating the conditions under which you can do. And this goes back to our own ego. Like I feel needed and useful when I'm doing more as opposed to like, you know, I am creating the conditions under which my kid can thrive. So one hack for this is, and usually this comes at the tail end of my hour-long keynote to parents, get a life and your kid can get one too. In other words, get a hobby that isn't your child. When parents are like, oh, my hobbies are my children. Oh, well, no, that's not so healthy for them.
I don't have time.
Right?
Right?
I'm proud. Like everything I do is for them. Well, you're not modeling for them what a healthy, thriving adult looks like. Okay. What you're saying is adults drop everything to serve their children. And you're turning them into little narcissists who will be in therapy one day in their 20s saying like, oh, I learned this from Lori Gottlieb, psychotherapist. She said, my 20-something patient clients will say, oh, I have this boyfriend. Oh, how's the boyfriend? Oh, I dumped him. Why'd you dump him? Well, we had a fight and he wouldn't, excuse me, he wouldn't take my side. So I dumped him.
Right.
Because she's been taught. Love means the other person drops everything to accommodate you because that's how she was raised with parenting, right? So one thing is get a hobby, get a vocation, get a job, develop your adult friendships, whatever, lean into your lover, your partner, your spouse, if you have one, like, so that your entire life isn't watching your kid's every move. Get off the parenting portal where you're refreshing their grades every moment.
Please do that.
Okay.
Yes,
it is a surveillance culture that is harming kids. It's harming. It's just like, but it's evidence that like you are so wrapped up in this person's existence that you're hitting refresh to calm your own dysregulation, right?
Yeah.
Let me give you another story. Can I give you another story?
Oh, please.
All right. My son, 24. I have a great daughter too, 22, but my stories, he's the one that lives with us still. So I got more stories right now.
I'm sure he loves
that. In the pandemic, it was 2021. George Floyd had been murdered, you know, 9 months earlier. We're a Black family and multiracial family. And my kid is going to be a summer camp counselor. He's got the COVID vaccine and he's going to be a camp counselor. He's well enough. Like he's been through the depths of depression, but he's, you know, he's emerging from that. He's ready to go. And the camp director texts him or emails and says, Sawyer, I want to talk with you about camp this summer and what we're going to do around DEI to be more inclusive. Like everybody had awakened to the imperative of being more inclusive and careful around people of color because of George Floyd. Like we all remember that. So I come down to the kitchen. I don't know any of this. I come down to the kitchen. My son is looking like sort of worried and terrified. And I'm like, what's up, kid? You all right? And he's like, yeah, Jeff wants to talk to me about how we're going to make camp more inclusive this summer. And I just don't know if I have anything to say. And part of me is like, what? Yeah, put it on the one Black kid to solve the problem, right? Like I had a little bit of that, but I had been working in family therapy on how not to fix. Because the fixer in me would have been like, oh yeah, that sounds hard. Like let's, you know, want me to sit there on the call with you while you talk to him and like I can pass you notes. Right?
But write you a script.
I can write you a script, right? But I knew not to do that. So I regulated myself. I was like, wow. Compassion. I said, that sounds really hard. Are you okay? He was like, I don't know. I mean, I just, I don't want to let Jeff. I was like, Yeah, sweetie, that does sound hard. And then I pause and like my little heart is fluttering because I don't want my kid to feel anything is hard. And then I looked at him and I said, but you know what? You do hard things.
Yeah.
And I kind of stayed. I didn't like get all up in his face. I was like, you do hard things. Smile, confidence. And his eyes flew open and he was like, I do hard things. I do. I was like, you do. So then we're like nodding at each other. And then I was like, you know, I'm going to go out to my office, which is where I'm talking to you from now, in my backyard.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm going to be in my office. If you need me, I'll be in my office. But I think you got this. And I walked away backwards to the door. And that turned out to be the pivot that was the first of many steps I would take to regulate my own fear of my son's emotions, of is he capable? Let him have the experience. Let him go into it simply with these loving words where I express compassion and confidence that he can try this thing, right? Let me regulate myself so that I can get out of his way. We call it doing less. I don't think it's doing less. The amount of work it took for me to regulate myself was immense. It's just a different type of doing, right? Instead of doing the thing, the fixing, the handling, the arranging, it's okay. My job is to work on myself to not need to do the thing so that I don't deprive my kid. My kid needs the opportunity to do the thing. We need to flip. The language needs to be like, why would I deprive my child of the chance to learn in this moment?
Correct. Yeah. Exactly. The deprivation, I love that because it does change it to, it's not that I'm not helping him. It's I'm giving him the opportunity.
Yeah.
I'm going to let him have this one. I'm not going to take it for myself.
Yeah.
And I think that's a language that might help us feel better about doing it. Because I think it is something that even, and I had one client and I love her dearly. And we worked really hard with her for her older son and, you know, letting go. She was very much involved, finally let go, turned out well. He actually took ownership of his life and called me because she was having the same problem with her second child where she still couldn't let go. She's like, I can't, even though I know how this works, still, everything in me just won't let me do it. And I think that's the hardest thing is for us to be aware of it, but to be able to be okay letting go of that death grip that we have.
Yeah.
Let's do this. Let's end. I just want to do one golden nugget to give the listeners to walk away with.
The golden nugget is your child is actually a separate person from you. And they are a gift from the universe or God or however you believe we all get here. And your job is not to live their life for them, but simply prepare the conditions under which this precious gift will sort of become themselves. They are a wildflower. You don't even know what they're going to look like or be like. You just create the right conditions where this wildflower can become their glorious selves.
I love that. What a great place to close. Thank you, Julie, so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Cam, and to everyone who listened. Hope you got something good and useful out of it. Appreciate you.
And that's a wrap. Thank you, parents, for taking time out of your busy day to listen in. I appreciate you. If you found the episode enlightening, please like, review, and share with a friend navigating the teen years. Until next time, stay curious. Remember, there's always more to the story than what you see.